Welcome, everybody. This is the Rochelle, the Right Now Coach, and this is the Right Now Mastermind class. Our guest today is Deborah Brennigan, author of Shame the Devil, and she's going to be talking to us about writing historical fiction. Deborah Brennigan received her doctorate in creative writing from the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. She is an assistant professor of English at Westminster College in Fulton, Missouri. For her fiction, she has received a Ragdale residency and was a recent finalist for the John Gardner Memorial Fiction Prize, the Cincinnati Review's Prose Prize, and the Crab Creek Review Fiction Prize. Her work has appeared or is forthcoming in Calix, Tampa Review, The Laurel Review, Real, The Southern Women's Review, and many other publications. Deborah Brennigan's novel, Shame the Devil, a historical account of 19th century American writer Fanny Fern, is out from SUNY Press. So for more information on Deborah and links to her website and a wonderful article on the blog, please visit my website, rightnowcoach.com. I will be having a giveaway for Deb's book probably next week, so keep an eye on the blog if you'd like to win a copy of Shame the Devil. Deborah, welcome. I'm so glad to have you with us.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
So, full disclosure, Deborah and I are friends. We've known each other for over 10 years, started in a writing group many years ago, and I'm so excited about this novel about Fanny Fern. So why don't you start by telling us a little bit about who Fanny Fern is and how you first learned about her?
Well, probably like a lot of people, I had never heard of Fanny Fern. And when I was in graduate school, one of my professors said to me, he was a teacher of a 19th century literature course, American literature course, and he kept saying to me, oh, there's this writer I've just found out about. Her name is Fanny Fern, and you should read her. And I kept thinking, I've never heard of her. Why have we never heard of her? So he put her on the reading list for the next class that I signed up for with him. And he was right. I just loved her the minute I read her novel, which was very famous in her time. And I've learned a lot since then. In graduate school, I was so fascinated with her that I wrote a lot of papers about her. I did a ton of research. I applied for and received a fellowship to go to Smith College to look through her archives and completely, look at all of her papers and records and everything like that. And Fanny Fern was the highest paid, most popular writer of her era. And her era was the era of Nathaniel Hawthorne, Walt Whitman, Herman Melville, all these iconic male writers that we all know. She was Walt Whitman's mentor. Nathaniel Hawthorne adored her. Harriet Beecher Stowe was her great friend. The amazing thing to me is that Fanny was right in the middle of all this. In fact, was at the top of this group, and she has basically been largely forgotten by people.
Wow! And you the way you write about her and talk about her, it's like she was a celebrity. Can you talk about what that meant for her in her era? And if you could give us her date. For those of us who are historically challenged, that would be great.
Sure. Well, she was born in 1811 and died in 1872. And most of the novel, though, takes place between 1850 and 1870. So that's her era. And, yes, she was really considered one of America's first celebrities. In fact, people who do research about celebrities often cite her as one of the early, people. And the interesting thing was she didn't know how to handle this. Nobody knew, there was no precedent. Nobody knew how to deal with her, and she didn't know how to deal with all of the attention that she would always get. So what she did was, because it was unfeminine to be out in public in that era, and it was considered vulgar and coarse to promote yourself and to be sort of the limelight, especially if you were a woman, she kind of hid. she would you know, stay away from public gatherings, and if she went somewhere, she didn't call attention to herself. So people were always trying to figure out where she was and who she was. And if somebody figured out, oh, there's Fanny Fern, a mob would sort of follow her, and this for her was quite frightening. And so she learned to protect herself, I guess, like celebrities now. But at the time, this really didn't happen to a lot of other people, so it was a brand new experience.
Wow. Mm-hmm. So this novel is based on the life of a real person, and so you mentioned a little bit about the research you did. You want to talk a little bit about how much research you did and then how you went about kind of figuring out where to look and, you know.
Sure. Well, yeah. I started off just reading her work, you know, and writing papers about. She's written a couple of novels. The main thing that she wrote, though, were newspaper columns and newspaper articles. She was a columnist similar to, like, Anna Quinlan. She was sort of, you know, right on the cusp of social issues and always pushing the envelope for progressive ideas in her era. And so I read all these things, and I was always writing papers, and then I decided I was really interested in her personal life, because the more I learned about her personal life, she was, she had three marriages, she was widowed. After she was widowed, she was sort of forced into a marriage of convenience with a wealthy man who was extremely abusive. She ended up leaving him, which was unheard of in that era. And she was scandalized because of that. And so then that's when she started hiding and tried to figure out how to make a living. And so at first she started hiding because she was, you know, the scandalous woman, and later she had to hide because she was a celebrity. And eventually she married another man 11 years younger than she was, penned one of the country's first prenuptial agreements, because at that point she was a multimillionaire. So I just found out so much about her that I, as I said, applied for a fellowship, went to Smith College. They have a Sophia Smith collection there. A lot of famous and not so famous women's archives are there. And I was there for, a little less than 2 weeks, and I would just go to the library every single day and work as long as I could, and the archivists were absolutely fantastic in helping me wade through all these boxes and boxes of material, everything from, you know, the kitchen tiles that were, you know, in her childhood home, snippets of her wedding dress, actual, you know, letters and diaries, copies of all of her professional writings, photographs and daguerreotypes, and on and on and on, so many treasured and personal things of hers. And the more I sat there doing this research, the more I realized I wanted to write a historical novel about her. I really wanted to put all of this together that I was researching, not just the biographical details, but the essence of this, and who I, you know, this person who I was finding out to be, you know, she was an amazing, strong, and progressive woman. I wanted her to become known again. I thought it was an incredible shame that she's been forgotten about, and I just thought people need to know her story.
Wow. I'm hearing a little feedback on the line, so if that's you, if you're breathing hard or if you're moving a lot, you can mute yourself with *6. And that just preserves the recording for those who can't be with us or those of you who would like to listen again.
It's totally thunderstorming here, so maybe that's part of the problem, yeah.
Crash, boom. And if you get knocked off the line, just call back in. I've heard it beep a couple of times, and that's just fine. Just call right back in. So, you know, you mentioned that you found all this amazing stuff and you wanted to recreate her and help people understand her. I'm curious why you decided to do a novel instead of a nonfiction biography about her.
You know, I was asked that question by my publisher, too, because I had done so much research. And the fact of it is there have been several really good biographies done about Fanny Fern. Some were done around the time of her death. One was done by her husband. Another was done by our granddaughter a few years later. There were scholars in the 40s and 50s who wrote a little bit about her, and then scholars in the 1970s and 80s who wrote more about her. And so I felt like those works were kind of pointed to academics, and I really felt like there was enough information about Fanny Ferne for that particular audience already. Although, you know, I was certainly still contributing to that group and, you know, kept reading all the articles and book chapters and everything I could get my hand on that were produced in, you know, these academic journals and stuff like that. But I wanted to reach a different audience, a broader audience. I wanted to have her story accessible to anybody, to just an everyday person who wanted to pick up a book and learn about Fanny Ferne in a way that, I'm not saying biographies are dry, they can be extremely interesting, and I, of course, loved reading her biographies, but I thought in a way that might feel more like a story and that might be a little easier to take in all of the information. And so that's why I thought I would try a historical novel.
So I'm curious, you know, when you're doing a historical novel, how do you decide what real events to include from the historical person's real life, and then how do you decide what you're going to fictionalize? And you know, and then the question then again is like, what's ethical? What are the ethical implications of it?
Right. And well, because this was my dissertation project too, I felt very compelled to make it as historically accurate as I possibly could. And so every detail about Fanny Ferne, as far as the plot goes, actually is true. I, you know, worked really, really hard to validate everything, to check multiple sources, to make sure that she was here on this date, that she interacted with this person in this way, that these events actually happened the way they did, because I didn't want to bring out the story and have people be misled by it. So I really felt like, as far as the events of her life and also all of the other characters in the book, Walt Whitman and Harriet Beecher and on and on and on, I researched each of those people and made sure that these things were historically accurate. But the fictionalization comes in when you don't know the thoughts of the characters, and you don't know maybe the exact dialogue that went on. And so I would know, for instance, that Fanny, you know, was going to visit her daughter, who she had to leave with relatives because she was too poor to take care of her. And I knew that she had to walk 10 miles instead of taking the train to go and visit her daughter. And so I thought, what would you be thinking about if you were walking along, you know, you were too poor for train fare to go and visit your daughter for one of only three times that you got to visit her over a several-year period, this daughter that you have had to have left with relatives because you can't afford to support your own child. So that kind of stuff I made up. But I tried to make it very consistent with the Fanny that I'd come to know, you know, based on the personality that I found in her letters, in her journals, and in all of her professional writing, because she left a lot of writing behind. She was, like I said, a columnist for almost 20 years. And so she had a weekly column that's a lot of work. And so I got to really get a feel for how would she feel? What would she think? And actually, there were many instances that I pulled right from her columns, right from her letters and journals, because, you know, here it was, a scene. She's already told us about it. I included that scene, and she told us already her feelings and thoughts. So, you know, that's kind of, you know, how I tried to do it, and I tried very hard to make it as historically accurate as I possibly could.
So when you're, you know, just a little method question, when you're pulling stuff right from her writing, mm-hmm. do you differentiate that in the text from your own writing, or is it kind of all hidden and the reader just...
Yeah, that is an excellent question, and that's one I was confused about for a long time. I didn't know, you know, is this okay to do or is this not okay to do? I've actually got epigraphs at the beginning of each chapter of her actual columns, you know, some snippets from her actual writing. But the other things, like, you know, when I said I would, for instance, talk about her walk to visit her daughter, or her earliest memory of her mother was when her mother took her to this alternative worship service. Those kind of things that she wrote about, I found out that if you are a fiction writer, you can use any and all primary and secondary sources that you find in your work, as long as you don't use the exact words, and as long as you are sure that this is, you know, is, well, I mean, if you're a good historical novelist, you're going to want it to be historically accurate. You're not going to want to take, you know, information that only one person has written. And so I would check and make sure that, yes, this is true, this really happened, and I would write up her experiences, staying close to the way she described it, trying to preserve her tone and the emotion without using, of course, her exact words.
Wow.
So, and that's one thing I talked with my publisher about, and, you know, they assured me that this is, you know, this is the way you write good historical fiction. And it kind of goes against the grain of academic writing, where you cite everything. You know, you're citing even summarized or paraphrased sources. And in fact, you know, some of the things I write are indeed paraphrased and summarized from her different writings. And so,
well, it's kind of interesting, because if your students did this, they'd probably fail. But
if they do it in academic writing, exactly, because that's nonfiction.
Right.
But fiction is a different story. Fiction,
yeah.
Historical fiction, even, so it's kind of this blended genre, I guess you could say. It's reliant upon real historical detail and fact, but it does not have to, you don't have to adhere to the rules of citation, because
yeah.
It's not an academic work. Although I do list at the beginning of my book a whole list of sources, and, you know, where I got certain things, and on and on and on, and when I quoted Fanny's original writing, you know, when I did it verbatim, I would list the exact, you know, publication and date of when it first came out.
Wow. Well, I want to move on a little bit to some of these other historical figures you write about, because it seems to me that when you're writing about people like Walt Whitman and Harriet Beecher Stowe, people who have been, you know, who've written a lot, been published a lot, there's been a lot of biographies,
mm-hmm.
A lot of historical fiction, and probably even kind of movie and film recreations of their life. I'm guessing that's could be challenging. So I'm wondering how you go about kind of creating those characters.
That is another good question. You're exactly right in that those different characters who were more famous than Fanny were sometimes a challenge. And in fact, I worked with one of my 19th century American literature professors to make sure that I was really clear about the details about Walt Whitman, because in the book, Fanny and Walt Whitman have a sort of up and down relationship. And so I know Walt Whitman is sort of, you know, an icon of, you know, the poetic world, and I wanted to make sure I wasn't going to be insulting, and that at the same time I wanted to give an accurate portrayal of Fanny and Walt Whitman's relationship from Fanny Fern's perspective. And so that was a decision I had to make early on, that I was portraying all of these characters in regard to how Fanny Fern saw them, how she interacted with them, not how we, as, you know, critics and readers, you know, from 150 years later, look at them, you know, from like an omniscient point of view. So I thought, as long as I'm true to her perspective, then I'm being accurate as far as Fanny Fern's story. Because, you know, I'm sure a lot of people will, you know, wonder about, especially Fanny Fern and Walt Whitman's relationship in this, and there have been scholars, I can't even tell you how many, who have written about Fanny Fern and Walt Whitman. The last time I Googled it, there were 16,000 entries. So
wow.
There's a lot of discussion about it. So it was fun to portray these different people. The other thing that was really challenging and very, very enjoyable for me to do was to humanize these iconic literary figures. I wanted them to actually come alive for people and let people realize they were living, breathing human beings with flaws and strengths, and they were funny and they were mean, and they, you know, they had the whole range of human characteristics. They were not just the, you know, marble bust that we see of them in the library, you know.
And you do a good job, because I think that's one of the enjoyable things for me about historical fiction is when you kind of bump up against these people that you read about in high school or college or just on your own, and it's like, oh wow, here they are. So I'm curious, you know, you were so fortunate. You were writing this while you were in a PhD program. Mm-hmm. Most of us are sitting alone in our offices writing it between wiping our children's butts and, you know, taking the dog for a walk and all that other stuff. So what sort of advice would you give to novelists who want to write believable historical fiction? What are some things that we can do to do a good job?
Well, I think the number one thing is to make sure that your research is solid. And there's a couple of different ways to think about research. The first way is to think about the primary and secondary sources, about your particular era or the event, like a lot of people write about the Civil War or something like that, or the particular person that you're writing about. So you want to research those areas very, very carefully, get the facts straight. I mean, that's number one. But then the second part of research is what I call ancillary research. It's trying to get a feel and flavor for the era, you know, for the language, for the social mores, for customs, for dress, for food, what the houses were like, you know, what kind of couches did they sit on. You know, what were the daily routines of people? What were the city streets like? The buildings, on and on and on. And so you have to really work hard not to have anachronisms in your work. And so that was one of the things that challenges, I think, every historical writer, trying to make sure that you're being accurate to the historical era that you're writing about. So I wrote for the plot. And then I went through and I added what I considered, you know, details of the era. And I would try to make sure that when I said somebody looked out a window, they weren't looking out a picture window that, you know, we didn't really think about those words until maybe the 1950s, that they were maybe looking out of a, you know, shuttered window or, you know, something like that. So I went through very carefully with the details and made sure that all of those things were historically correct. For instance, at one point I had Fanny get an ice cream cone with her daughter, and I thought, I want to make sure you could get an ice cream cone in Boston, you know, in the, you know, early 1850s. So I had to go and check, and sure enough, I found out she couldn't get an ice cream cone, but she could get a little paper cup of ice cream. And so I had to change my little scene and have them paper cup of ice cream instead of an ice cream cone. So details like that, I think you have to be careful about.
So in a sense, you've got to kind of, once you've got the story written, you've got to approach it almost like an editor or an outsider and just really be curious and say, huh, I wonder if they really would be walking on this kind of a surface.
Exactly. Exactly. You might just say cobblestones, but then you have to think, is it cobblestones? You know, when did cobblestones become the popular paver? Because if it's 10 years later, you have already, you know, sort of pulled readers out of your book who know about cobblestones. They're going to say, wait a minute, that's not correct, and they suddenly have lost that magical moment.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I'm curious, you know, I just finished reading Eric Larson's book on the Chicago World Fair, and I read in his notes that he does not use the Internet. He only uses books, you know, books and other kind of primary sources. Okay. I'm curious about you and how you made that decision. You know, what did you use secondary sources that were online? Did you just use, you know, kind of the primary sources and other second stories that were in print? Or how did you...
How did I do that? Well,
yeah.
When I was researching this book, this has been 9 years in the making. So I was researching between 2002 and early 2005, and believe it or not, the internet was not as developed as it is right now. And so although it was there, obviously, but it wasn't as extensive as it is right now. So I did a lot of the primary research, like Eric Larson was saying, reading the books, the journal articles, the actual physical things. I also, though, would use the internet for things like the ice cream cone to, you know, see about those details. I think the internet was perfect for those kinds of things. But in addition, I also did things like I read books that were called something like What Life Was Like in the Mid-1800s, or, you know, Everyday Cooking in, you know, the 1850s, or, you know, something like that. So I would, like, page through these historical books that would talk about what the frying pans looked like, what the shoes were like, if they were buttons or ties or whatever, so that I could get all that stuff and all that stuff correct, and I would just sort of have those reference books sitting all around me as I wrote. But in addition, I watched films, you know, to sort of get a feel for, you know, the details, because filmmakers have the same problems that historical novelists have in making sure that their era is depicted correctly. And I also read a lot of other fiction from that era, because just reading work of writers from the time that Fanny Fern was alive, you know, I could kind of slip into, you know, ideas about dress and culture and food and you know, day-to-day activities and stuff like that. So that kind of helped. And I also visited museums. There was an excellent museum in New York, and I went to New York and sort of walked around where Fanny Fern was, and I saw her houses, and I, you know, figured out where she and Walt Whitman would meet and things like that. And there was a museum there called the Merchant's House Museum, and it was set up from the 1860s, which is exactly the period that Fanny Fern lived in, or very, very close to a time when she lived in a merchant's house with her second husband, who was a merchant. And so I could get an idea of what her life was like and what luxury meant in that era. And then I also got to actually walk through one of Fanny Fern's houses. It had been remodeled, but the owners let me come in, and I could sort of imagine the spaces that, you know, she lived in. So all of that kind of research, I think, is really important, too. The primary and secondary research, I spent, like I said, over 2 years just reading. And then all this other research is important to sort of get the feeling in your bones.
Well, and, you know, as you're talking, I'm thinking, oh, this is a lot of work. And I'm thinking, you know, there are days when, like, I will actually avoid reading a historical novel because it seems like it's going to be hard. And that's just my idea, because it really isn't that hard to read a historical novel. But I'm thinking, you know, it seems harder to write historical fiction than modern fiction. And so I'm wondering what some of the common problems writers of historical fiction encounter, or what were the problems that you encountered, and how did you solve them? You know, and how did you keep your kind of energy going when it got tough?
Yeah. Well, it's harder in some ways and it's easier in others, because I also write a lot of contemporary fiction. And so the way that it's easier is that you already know the plot and you already know all the characters. You don't have, you know, so right there's a lot of invention that you don't have to worry about. But you do have to do a lot of the research in the historical era. And if it's something that you love and it's an era and a person or whatever that you love, that's just glorious fun. You know, it's something that, you know, you just doodle around. And, in fact, some people get so lost in research that they research for too many years. So in that respect, it was kind of nice when I was writing the novel. I knew exactly where it was going. I knew all the crisis periods. I knew all the turning points. I knew how it would start, and I knew how it would end. And so that's very different from other works that I write when I have to invent the story and invent the characters. So I feel like it sort of balances out the fact that you're doing a lot of research and detail work, but you don't have to think about a plot or characters. You just have to make sure you get them down in what you hope is an accurate way.
So I want to ask you kind of a technical question. I'm just like impressed and overwhelmed a little bit by all of the details and dates that you had to keep straight when you wrote this book. And, you know, I know that you're dealing with the timelines of a lot of people and their intersection with each other. So I'm curious if you used a spreadsheet or how you were able to do this kind of physically. I think just knowing this might help our listeners who are dealing with their own time periods.
Yeah. I must say I was not as organized as I should have been. I wish I would have had a spreadsheet. But I basically, again, this was sort of the detail work that I did after I put the main points down. I mean, if I knew dates, I put them in as I was writing. But if I wasn't exactly sure, I was constantly looking things up. You know, so I did. I had Harriet Beecher Stowe's timeline. I had Walt Whitman's timeline. I had James Parton's timeline. I had Fanny Fern's timeline. I had her brother Nat Willis's timeline. I had all these different people. And at one point when I showed the book to one of my dissertation professors, and I had, I don't know, I had Nathaniel Hawthorne doing something, and he said, well, he couldn't be here because he was in Liverpool during these years. And I went, oh, yeah. So it was little things like that you're right, you have to keep track of all those details. And I just found myself looking things up over and over again and checking and rechecking because I was worried about getting something wrong. And I also wanted to make sure that the dates were verified by more than one source, because a lot of times when you're dealing with this information that's 150, 200 years old, there's really no exact accurate record anywhere. And so I might look in one biography that says, oh, Fanny Fern was married on this date. And then another biography will have it 5 days later. And then the newspaper article will have it 2 days before. And so I'll have to go, well, which one is correct? And then if I see three or four or five sources agreeing with one out of those three, then I have to decide, okay, you know, the majority of people who write about the date of the wedding put it at this date. I'm going to do that too.
Wow.
So the dates weren't always something that scholars agreed upon. And so I would get as close as I could, but I would really do an educated, weighted guess in those situations, you know, to see, you know, which of these biographers do I trust the most, how many people agree or not.
Well, and I'm curious, you know, as you make kind of decisions like that, how did you escape the research for the rest of my life trap? And that's what I see with so many writers, is that they, with these research-heavy projects, and I know Ann Patchett said what she does is she writes the book first, or at least tries to get halfway through the book before she does any research. I'm just curious how you do it, how you did it.
I think that is a problem that a lot of people have, especially if you're researching things that you love. And for me, it was nice to have a dissertation to write and a deadline for that, a self-imposed deadline. And I think I loved, you know, I saw Ann Patchett and I heard her say that too, and I loved that idea, because I think that sometimes you do so much research and you get all of this information, much of which will never make it into the book. I'm not saying that's research you shouldn't have done, because it still gives you a full idea of the person that you're you know, writing about. But I also think that you have to like impose some kind of limitation on yourself, because you will go forever researching, and the hardest thing, as any writer knows, is sitting down and actually getting this stuff onto paper.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, and one, you know, you're talking about imposing limitations. The other thing that I notice about historical fiction, and probably why I dread reading it sometimes is that some authors just can't help themselves, and they just include every detail that they found, you know, and it's like, okay, enough description. Tell me what she's feeling. So I'm curious, how did you avoid that?
Well, I hope I avoided it.
Yes, you did.
I think what I did is I had a lot of readers go through, you know, read my manuscript and give me their opinions and things like that before I tried to get it published. And there were certainly sections that I went, at first, on and on and on with. I ended up cutting my book by 100 pages when I revised it. So that was a lot of extra things that, you know, that I took out. And one scene in particular I remember, there was a scene where Catherine Beecher and Fanny Fern sort of make a peripheral visit to a women's insane asylum. And I had done a ton of research about this because I teach a course at Westminster College called Women and Madness in Literature. And so for that course, I researched all kinds of, you know, all kinds of information about asylums and women and insanity and psychiatric treatments and on and on and on. And Fanny Fern wrote against a lot of this stuff, and she was, again, so progressive in terms of just, you know, humane treatment of all people and, you know, early psychology and all of that. And she would write about jails and insane asylums and almshouses and places like that that would treat people who were down on their luck or in some way, you know, had made a mistake, and they would treat these people as little more than animals. And so I wanted to show how she felt about that particular social issue, and I ended up writing a scene that was 40 pages long, which is way too long. So I had to cut out a lot of my very favorite parts. And just, it's still one of the longest scenes in the book. It's not 40 pages, though, so people, I hope you're not afraid.
I don't want to scare anybody. And really, you know, this is a great book. And once I start reading historical fiction, I love it. It's just, I have a mental block, and I don't know where it came from, because, you know, I've read a ton of historical fiction, and long, 1,200, 1,500 pages of historical fiction. But every so often I'll come across one of those books that's like, you know, enough with the details, or at least it's the clothes and the shoes, you know, and the food. I don't care about the cars.
Right.
So I'm curious about the publication process. I haven't tried to publish anything from the genre. I don't know much about what it's like.
Mm-hmm.
So what was it like for you? Did you use an agent? Did you do this on your own? Share with listeners.
This was surprisingly... I think relatively easy for publication. I had finished my revisions and had polished the manuscript, you know, as to the point where I, you know, felt really comfortable with it. And I had just sent it. I sent query letters to a couple of agents. I think two agents, and I maybe sent query letters to two other publishers. And then I went to a writer's conference. The AWP conference, and I had in my hot little hand a stack of abstracts about my book. And I walked around to all the tables, you know, with the different publishers there, and at each table I'd ask the person standing there, do you publish historical novels? If they said no, I would just walk right on. If they said yes, you know, we'd chat a little and see if there's any interest. At that particular conference, I found maybe five different publishers who had at least the beginning interest to my novel. And one of them was SUNY Press. And I remember when I I walked up to James Peltz, who I didn't realize, but he was the acquisition editor, and I asked him if he'd, you know, published historical novels. And he said, well, only if they have something to do with New York, because our press, you know, we publish academic works, and then we have an imprint called Excelsior Editions, and we publish all kinds of things, poetry, fiction, creative nonfiction, cookbooks, whatever, anything that has to do with New York. And so I thought, ooh, ding, ding, ding. Half of Fanny Fern's life was in New York, and half of my book takes place in New York. So I told him that. I said, does that count? And he said, yeah, that would count. And so I told him a little bit about Fanny Fern. I gave him my abstract. I followed up with him. He wanted to see the whole manuscript. He read it. He presented it presented the manuscript to his editorial board. They liked it. They came back at me with questions at first, and their main question was, why don't you make this a nonfiction biography? Because they are a press that publishes that kind of thing. And I gave them the same answer that I gave you, that I really wanted a wider audience, and I really felt like this creative work would be more fun and easier for people to get into, especially with, you know, short chapters. I think most of my chapters are only on average about 6 or 7 pages long. And so he said, good enough, you know, I like that answer. And he went back to his board and convinced them, and 6 months later I had a contract.
Wow, that is very exciting.
Yeah.
So I want to open it up to the group. I have tons more questions. I could talk to you all day about this, but I want to make sure the people who are here get a chance to ask their questions. So if anybody in the group has a question, you can unmute your individual line by pressing *7. Go ahead and ask it. If you don't ask it, I'm sure I can fill the time with questions. Does anybody have a question? Sometimes our listeners are quite quiet. Does anybody have a question of our guest?
Okay. I gave somebody else a few seconds. Yes, I have a question. This is Beth Hoffman. I'm calling from New Mexico. I live in Wisconsin. I have just finished what seemed to me a hugely long book, and I will not identify it. But in the early part of the book, left ear is not specified. It's the right ear that's specified. Then way later in the book, twice, left ear is identified. And my question is, how do you, Deborah, keep track of these kinds of details so you don't make this kind of embarrassing switch in your book?
It is difficult. You do a word search through your whole document over and over again to make sure you have everybody's name spelled correctly, that you remembered what color hair they have and eyes, and on and on and on. The years, like I said, I just checked over and over. I had a lot of people, you know, help me, you know, looking through. And actually, now that the book is in print, one person did find one particular mistake where instead of 1851, it says 1951. And I don't know how many copy editors and myself and all kinds of people looked at that manuscript and did not see that. I think you have to try your very hardest, and then if a few mistakes come through, you have to, you know, say, okay, I gave it my 99.9%, you know, effort, or, you know, it's 99.9% as accurate as I can make it, and hope that people don't notice or something like that. But when it looks like somebody hasn't done enough research or enough editing, I understand it can be really frustrating to read.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, Beth, for that question. Others? Do other people have questions? Does anybody else have a question? While you're thinking of it, Deb, what is AWP? You mentioned going to AWP.
Yeah, the Associated Writers and Writing Programs, Association of Writers and Writing Programs. And it is the primary organization for people who teach creative writing and writers, a lot of creative writers. And so there's a convention once a year, and many, many thousands of people go. And so for me, it's my favorite convention to go to here.
If we're not members of AWP, or this isn't our kind of genre, do you know of some other places where historical fiction writers can connect with agents or publishers?
Well, actually, AWP, you could go for historical novels, but poetry, you know, short fiction, long fiction, any kind of creative writing, creative nonfiction, on and on and on, is at AWP. But also there's a historical, it's called Historical Novel Society. That is another big organization, and they have a conference every year for people who just write historical novels or just want to read historical novels. And so, whereas AWP is really geared mostly for writers and teachers, the Historical Novel Society is geared to for writers and readers.
Oh, interesting. Good to know. Does anybody else have a question? Those of you hanging out in the background. I don't want to leave you behind. You can unmute yourself with *7 if you have a question.
And if you don't, I have a little comment to add.
Oh, go ahead. Why don't you do that?
Well, what are the, I think, you know, it makes it sound like this is such a difficult thing to do, and I have to say there was a lot of fun points in this novel, and I think some of the most fun parts were when I would get to depict these peripheral characters that were in Fanny Fern's life, because they had a much different personality than Fanny had, and so that can be one of the blessings of historical fiction, in that you get to have all these different characters. The peripheral characters, they, you know, you have a lot of information and data and all of that about them, but you can have a little more fun, I think, with them as well. And so I had a lot of fun depicting Fanny Fern's big brother, N.P. Willard.
Was that your favorite? I was curious about which was your favorite besides Fanny.
Yes, he was my favorite to write, although he and Fanny, you know, fought bitterly. But I loved writing his scenes, and I really liked writing her father and her father-in-law's perspectives, too. I think maybe it was for me to occasionally get into the head of a man was kind of a nice break, instead of always, you know, being in the head of, you know, either Fanny or Catherine Beecher or you know, women. I occasionally got to venture off into the men, and that for me was a nice change and a lot of fun.
That's great. Thank you. I'm glad you added that. And I do think it sounded like your research was really delightful, and I was thinking when you were saying that it must have felt almost like Christmas when you would discover like some hidden thing or some unique idea that she did that you didn't know before, or another journal or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was one day when I was sitting and looking through the archives at Smith College that I actually cried. I found this little tiny notebook. It was a little spiral notebook, which I didn't even know they made spiral notebooks back in the 1870s, which is when this was. And it had a note on it in the hand of her husband at the time that said, "Fanny's last writing." And she had scrawled her last newspaper column down, you know, days before she died, in this notebook. And so I got to see, like, it was like her dying words or something. I got to see the notebook that he, of course, saved, that somebody else saved after he died, that, you know, it was this treasured thing. And so I'm looking through this notebook, and I'm seeing her actual writing, and I was just overwhelmed. And, you know, and of course I had to put that in the book, but to sit there and discover little things like that were just, you know, something you can't get out of a book.
Oh, that's great. That is so exciting. And you help us to get it, because you have captured it for us. So that is really neat. I'm curious if anybody has any more questions. Okay. Does someone have a question?
The idea of writing fiction on research reminded me of the story of Johnny Tremaine. I don't remember the author, but the story I heard in children's literature was that this author did a whole lot of research about Paul Revere, and Johnny Tremaine was what she couldn't use in her book about Paul Revere.
Oh, that's fascinating.
Yeah, I remember as a little girl reading that and absolutely loving it. So maybe that's a precursor to people who want to write historical fiction or something like that. But so, yes, I remember that one, and it was. I really thought it brought the story of Paul Revere to life.
And I think, you know, that's a good comment to keep in mind, because sometimes the characters that end up being the best sources for historical fiction are the little known or the little written about.
Right. Johnny Tremaine.
Like Johnny Tremaine or Fannie Fern. So, Deb, what are you working on now? What's your next project?
Well, I just finished the first draft of another novel, and this one, though, is contemporary fiction. And it is the story of a college student who hides a pregnancy and gives birth without anybody knowing, and then must decide what to do with her baby. And the reason I started writing something like this is because I, you know, you read newspaper articles or whatever of people who either didn't know they were pregnant and show up at a hospital and deliver a baby, or they knew they were pregnant but nobody else around them knew. And I always wondered, how do you do this? You know, what goes through your head? What kind of life do you have in that time that you're pregnant and you can't tell anyone, or you don't want to tell anyone about any of it? And so that's what I explored in this story, this and is untitled at this point, in this latest novel that I wrote.
Neat. Wow. I can't wait to read it.
Thank you.
I'm curious, do you think you'll write more historical fiction?
Well, I'm not sure. I completely and thoroughly enjoyed writing about Fannie Fern, and I think the thing with historical fiction is that you have to get bitten by an idea or fall madly in love with an era or a person or something like that. And I, of course, did that with Fannie Fern. And when I was writing about her, I thought, oh, I'll never be able to do this again. It's like, you know, after you love your first child, you think, oh, I'll never love a second child. And then the second child comes along, and you love the second child, and it's like, wow. But I, just this summer, was assigned an essay to write for a journal about a woman, Nancy Hale, who is another forgotten writer. In fact, more forgotten than Fannie Fern, and equally famous. I mean, she was published, I don't know, 50 times in The New Yorker. And
wow.
Nobody's heard of her. In fact, there's no record. She's not in any anthology, and on and on. So I had to read some of her stories and write this essay about her. And there was a little part of me that thought, maybe. And then I found out that her archives are also at Smith College. And I thought, well,
wow.
I know the place.
At least I know the routine now, because you've done it before. Wow.
So who knows? Well, I'm not sure.
Well, we're almost out of time, so I want to remind our listeners where they can about your book and where they can find it. So I wanted to remind you that our guest is Deborah Brannigan. She is the author of the brand-new book on Fannie Fern, Shame the Devil. It's an exciting and interesting novel, and I highly recommend it to all of you. I will be reviewing it on my blog probably next week or early the week after, and then I will be raffling off a copy of the book that Deborah has so generously donated. So please keep your eye on the blog if you'd like to win a copy of the book. If you're interested in buying the book or learning more about Deborah, please visit my website, rightnowcoach.com, and you will find links to Deborah's website and her book, and you can also find a wonderful article she wrote on journaling in the blog last week. So, Deborah, it's been great to have you with us.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. It's been so much fun.
I
wonder if you have a final tip for our listeners.
Final tips. I would say for any writer, the number one quality or thing that you need to learn, or that I, of course, struggle with, is keep going. Never give up. Be persistent. If you have a great idea and you want to write about it and you want to see that published, then go ahead and do it. And don't let anything get in your way.
Oh, that's a great tip. Thank you, Deb. It's been great to have you with us.
Oh, thank you, Rochelle. It's been my pleasure.
This is Rochelle, the Right Now Coach. This has been the Right Now Mastermind class for July. Our guest has been Deborah Brennigan, author of Shame the Devil, out right now at your local independent bookstore. You can find out more about Deborah and get a link to her website and her book at rightnowcoach.com. Have a great day, everybody. Bye-bye.